right now on Earwolf. Bill Nye the Science Guy and Ophira Eisenberg join Nagin on Fake the Nation to discuss combating climate change and their mutual love of Canadian cereal. For more, follow at Earwolf on social media. Happy listening.
Hey everyone, this is Paul Scheer from How Did This Get Made, and I just wanted to remind you that you can find all of How Did This Get Made's archive and ad-free episodes on Stitcher Premium. For a free one-month trial of Stitcher Premium and access to a ton of great content, just go to stitcherpremium.com and use the code BONKERS. That's BONKERS, that's the code, for a one-month free trial of Stitcher Premium. Do it.
Ho, ho, ho. It's a How Did This Get Made Christmas miracle. We are doing two live virtual shows in December centering around Christmas movies. That's right. We wanted to bring a little How Did This Get Made home for the holidays, and you can join us on December 11th and December 18th. It's two Fridays in a row, and we're going to be doing some great holiday movies. Now, here's the deal. If you want to see both shows, it's $25. If you want to see either or show, it's $15. We're going to have a good time. I'm so excited to do these shows. For more information, go to hdtgm.com. You can see the movies that we're doing, and I believe they are available worldwide. So get on it. Go to hdtgm.com now, or after you listen to the episode. Beauty is bought by judgment of the eye, and a fart noise is given as a gift to the soul. We saw Kenneth Branagh's Love's Labor's Lost, so you know what that means.
Now it's time for How Did This Get Made? We're gonna have a good time, celebrate some failure, not just be a hater, cause you know you wonder, how did this get made? Let's wallow in the mediocrity of subpar art. Perhaps we'll find the answer to the question, how did this get made?
Hello, people of Earth, and welcome to How Did This Get Made? I am Tall John Scheer, and we have an interesting film, kind of continuing in our trend of movies that are combining genres that may not always fit together. We are talking about the 2000 Kenneth Branagh written and directed Love, Labor's Lost, which is, of course, a adaptation of Shakespeare, put into like a 1930s musical. Anyway, I'm not even going to describe the plot. I'm going to let the newsreel at the top of the movie do it for me.
September 1939. Ominous clouds of war may be gathering over Europe, but here in Navarre, the young king, seen here returning from military maneuvers, has announced an audacious plan for himself and his court. He and his companions are to cast off their military uniforms, while world events still allow, and devote themselves instead to a rigorous 3 years of study. That's right, 3 years. They'll sleep little, eat and drink less, and devote themselves instead to an inspiring program of self-improvement, a real feast for bookworms. Boldest of all, perhaps, is the king's absolute insistence that no women will be allowed inside the court. Sorry, ladies, but he is the king. It's a tall order, by golly, but this able young monarch, one of Europe's most eligible royal bachelors, seems determined to show the world there's more to life than guns and warfare. He is an idealist, but we wish him and his three chums the best. We bring you more news as the adventure unfolds, but for now we wish them bon voyage and good luck.
Thank you, Kenneth Branagh, as narrator, even though you were actually in the film, not as narrator. Okay, let's get into this. I'm going to break down this movie today with my two co-hosts. Please welcome Mr. Jason Manzoukas. How are you, Jason?
I feel personally like I'm on record. I don't like musicals. I don't like it when people sing. I'm not interested. I mean, I like it when people sing in other contexts, but within the context of this, especially this ham-fisted effort to shove the Great American Songbook into one of the lesser Shakespearean comedies was a debacle. So perfect for the show, but I did not enjoy this.
Well, for people who are listening, because it's a little bit different than our running order, we have just done in succession, Cats, Under the Cherry Moon, Break Into, and this. So all of them,
I mean,
really...
did we decide this? I don't remember. Did we decide we're going to do nothing but musicals and dance movies? Like, what is happening right now? Like, I feel like we're trapped in some sort of theme month or something like that.
Where most people are doing horror films for the month of October, are creating our own horror. Yeah.
This was eerie and creepy. This had elements that were terrible. terrifying. This was more upsetting to me than if I were to have watched Nightmare on Elm Street.
I agree. This was a movie where at certain points I would cover my eyes because of the singing and dancing. But I want to talk to someone who has a greater love of song and dance and Shakespeare. Please welcome my other co-host, Miss June Diane Raphael. How are you, June?
Oh, my gosh. I am okay, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. And I wanted to ask you about your first impressions about this. And then I want to call you out about something. So go ahead. What's your first impression?
I mean, I was excited to see it. Listen, I do think Shakespeare is not only our greatest playwright, but also our greatest poet. I do. I always get a little concerned when filmmakers, directors, stage directors want to modernize Shakespeare, because I feel like they don't trust the audience to actually just hear the story and hear the words.
I think it's also sometimes an effort for them to be like, look how clever I am drawing Shakespeare into modern times.
Right. You know? But you know what I've never seen? I've never seen just new music and new words thrown in there willy-nilly. I mean, that was a shock to the system. And
oh, right. He really used this as like a launch pad. It's kind of half Shakespeare, half not Shakespeare, and then just all the great American, like Jason said, the great American songbook. Like, you know,
yeah, I get so no kid. If people don't know, the musical numbers are, you know, not unique.
There's
They're
no
not made for this show. They
like
are Gershwin.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, that was the
yeah,
best song.
Exactly. I mean, it's Gershwin. It's Irving Berlin. It is like all of the great American songbook, sort of. I mean, sometimes it's just like a verse and a chorus. Sometimes it's just like a little taste of a song. It's not even fully done musical numbers. It's very, I don't know, it feels very slight.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. The way you smile just be.
But here's the weird thing, too, is like, it's so hard because they also took, I'm going to say it, I think one of Shakespeare's worst comedies plays. I mean, this is not, I guess it's like a comedy of manners or whatever. It's just there is, when I say no plot, I do mean no plot. The plot trappings that were there to, I guess, create conflict, mystery, mayhem. I didn't understand, and I didn't think worked. Like, I don't know what happened with the letter that was sent to the women. I don't really know if the men were in disguise and how the women tricked them. I mean, it was so
well. That's
thin.
The thing that sometimes Shakespeare, when you do it well, you can go along with. It's that thing where, like, sometimes you start watching Shakespeare and you're like, oh, I can't get access to this. And then you acclimate to the iambic pentameter and you acclimate to the speech. And then you're like, oh, now I'm in. I'm inside of it.
Right.
I get it. I'm enjoying it. This, though, it is, you know, one, it is, you know, 3/4, you know, Shakespeare play. It is 1/4 these songs or half songs or song elements. But then Branagh adds the hubris of Kenneth Branagh to feel as though he is the voice of Shakespeare for this generation.
Yes.
To me is a real problem, because then he inserts fake newsreel footage that is not in iambic pentameter that he's
is also a character in the movie. I was going to say, there's one part that you didn't add in into your mix of what he put here.
Go ahead.
I was going to say 2/3 Wayne's Brothers movie, because this movie is goofy and big. I mean, there is a fart noise in this film.
Hear it.
Oh, there is a fart. There is a fart in one section, because I
lurched up from the couch when I heard the
part
fart.
Part of me feels like, Paul, no offense.
Yeah.
Part of me feels like you farted during this movie and you're trying to convince June that it was the movie.
You know, this is an interesting fact.
We didn't watch it together.
Oh, okay.
Disregard. Yeah, this was a sauna bed viewing for me.
I'll be screening this in the sauna bed.
Yes.
Holy shit. Like, you know how much money we could raise if you could watch along with June in the sauna bed?
Oh my gosh. Why aren't we doing a How Did This Get Made sauna bed? I mean,
listen,
at this
I'm not
point,
getting in the same sauna bed with anyone. Not even
No.
Paul,
it's like
side
you,
by side sauna beds?
No, it's I'm more listening. Just like you are. No, it's like you're on Zoom, but you're on Zoom in the sauna bed. And
interesting.
And yeah, it doesn't matter.
Unfortunately, today, because I watched this in the morning in the sauna bed, and I do think a spider made its way into that sauna bed
what?
And ate me alive.
Oh God, no. That's terrifying.
Yeah, I know.
I found a spider in my bed the other night. I was like, what's your deal?
I've been spider free, guys. You're living in like a James Bond movie that's just a little bit with less stakes because like he had a tarantula.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, there's an update. Me and this spider are dating.
Oh, Jason, congratulations!
I'm so happy for you.
You know, quarantine makes strange bedfellows.
Did you get the spider tested before you guys? You know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. Full workup.
Here's what I'll say about this, and this is what I was gonna call June out about first. When I told you the movie that we were doing, you said to me. I said, oh, we're doing Love's Labor's Lost. And you said, oh, okay, I've seen that. And you seemed as if you were like, I don't know if I need to watch it again, as if it was that,
you know,
that
I got
present
I
in your
memory.
I thought
it was Much Ado. And I thought it was Kenneth Branagh and Emma.
Thompson.
And I loved the two of them.
Yes. That was a great one.
That was a great one. And by the way, Kenneth Branagh, I know, first of all, he's too old for this part.
Whoa!
Oh, my God.
I mean,
what was that casting?
So old!
I mean, he's literally with teenagers, it seems like.
Oh, I thought you were disagreeing with me.
No!
Yes. Oh,
hard
no.
Agree! Hard agree!
Absurd! It's honestly
comical.
You guys, it made me sad for him.
I was like, is he supposed to? And I was like, because I'm not super familiar with this play, I was like, am I forgetting? Is he the teacher?
No,
but I know.
No, you know, no.
It was not okay. But here's my question: why wouldn't I would have bought it more had he played the king?
Right,
like he's playing this sort of like super horny guy who doesn't want to sign this vow to fast and stay studying and not seeing women for 3 years. Like he can't keep away from them. And it just doesn't.
He is visibly a decade older at least than Alessandro Nivola.
Bare minimum. Yeah. And I will say this to his credit. He still looks the same age right now that he does in this film.
Oh, like, his Poirot. It's just big that make that mustache a little bigger and you have his Poirot from last year's or 2 years ago's Murder on the Orient Express.
I think a sequel is coming. Here's what I'll say. I think the reason why he's in this, the reason why he played this is because this is the role that Shakespeare is to have been believed to play. In the original production of it. So I feel like he was like, I am now taking this. By the way, just to put this in context, this is literally the next film he makes after the 4-hour Hamlet that is, you know, word perfect, like the full version of a,
Beautiful. And I haven't watched it in years, but which I remember thinking was very good.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Ziegfeld and I have a playbill for it.
I don't think Kenneth Branagh is trash at all. I do think he's an incredible Shakespearean actor and has spent a lot of his career, you know, forwarding and putting, you know, a lot of effort into getting Shakespeare stuff out there. And that I appreciate. But this is no good. This is.
No.
And oh, he is, wow.
He has a handle and a command of the language that not every actor in this movie does.
No.
And I appreciated it. I appreciated it. I heard it. And by the way, I don't either. clear. I auditioned for RADA. I did not get in. I was not accepted. So I tip my hat to Kenneth Branagh. I heard the words. He told the story.
Yes.
He miscast himself in a way that made me feel so bummed out for him, knowing that he directed it and just saw himself in this role. Although I have to say, he kept up with the dancing.
Well, let's talk about the dancing clearly. Because that's a very sliding scale that we're talking about here. Because
yeah,
this dancing is,
it is so basic. It is so basic what they're doing. It is, but it's filmed as if it's a Busby Berkeley musical, like incredible. You're not going to believe
style.
What we did, but it is so basic what everybody's doing.
That Busby Berkeley water scene is so unimpressive that it was upsetting to me, because like obviously if you know anything about those numbers, they're in the water, they look amazing, everyone's choreographed, they're in a pool, in an indoor pool. It looks as if, and this is how I feel about the whole movie, like a bunch of kids decided, oh, let's just try to do that, and we'll, you tape it, dad, on our camera, and they're like, oh yeah, dad's like, I'll tape it, and that's what it feels like. And the whole thing feels like, I wrote this down, is like, it feels like an inside joke of a musical theater class. Like, this is all like, oh, we'll do this, oh my gosh, that would be so much fun, we'll do this, and that's the vibe that I'm getting the entire time, and it made me cringe at certain points.
Well, that is how I feel at all musicals. That's how I feel at all musicals. I'm like, oh, why are you doing this? Oh, don't do this. Oh, you know, and these are songs I genuinely love. You know, like,
yes,
these are even better. These are wonderful songs, you know, and that they are so lifeless and so uninteresting to watch both performed and to listen to how they're sung. It is passionless. A play that is fundamentally about passion and joy and love is without all of those things.
Hey everybody, how are you? It's Tall John Shear, and I think you've probably noticed a trend going on, I know I have, that people are decking their houses out early for the holidays this year. I mean, I've seen trees up, I've seen lights up, I've seen wreaths ready to go. And you know what? How Did This Get Made wants to join in the holiday fun, because we're going to do two live shows, just like the Cats show. We're going to do two live shows, and they're going to both happen in December, December 11th and December 18th. And they're both going to be holiday movies. One ticket is $15. If you want to buy tickets for both, it's $25. I'm going to tell you, you can find out all this information and more by just going to hdtgm.com. That's our official website. You can find out where the tickets are and everything like that. And thank you.
Well, that right there is Matt McConkey.
And this is Dave Holmes. You are Dave Holmes.
I am Dave Holmes. And we together host the Homophilia podcast. What's it all about, Matt?
It's the show where we interview LGBTQ celebrities on what they're loving and who they're loving. So we talk about pop culture obsessions, and then we get deep into their love lives and sexy times. Everybody that you've ever loved, from everybody from the Drag Race family to Jonathan Van Ness and Jesse Tyler Ferguson and Margaret Cho and on and on and on.
Matt Bomer, Andrew Scott, Lena Waithe, Samantha Ronson. Oh, it is an absolute queer hit parade. New episodes come out every single Friday. Get it on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts.
June, when you looked at Alicia Silverstone, who I kept my eye on during that water scene, that was the time that I feel like everyone was, and talking to what you were saying too, Jason, like dead eyes. I felt like everyone had dead eyes. Like, they're all like doing the moves. And I think this made me appreciate dancing more than I ever have, because I think that you can dance and be in do choreography so much that you forget to have your face react to it, and you're just doing it. And I felt like that there's a handful of times I watch people just like,
They are there's nothing. There's nothing
like
there.
I was watching Matthew Lillard panic throughout every dance number. An actor who I genuinely like, I was like, he looks terrified right now. I felt like he was like trying to remember what do I do next?
I mean, it's just so interesting though, because you just get the sense as an audience, like this movie is panicked.
Yes.
Panicked. And they're throwing these dance sequences in these songs because they don't trust, it feels like they don't trust what the story is. And
they have reason to.
That's true, but it doesn't, they're also not dancers. So I do think it's a lot to take actors who are not necessarily Shakespearean actors, have them do this text, act this text, tell this story, and then have non-singers and non-dancers also do giant musical numbers.
I agree. It's a tall order. 100%. You're asking too much of people. Just to execute a good version of this play is hard, never mind adding song and dance to it. And none of these people are song and dance people,
literally,
Kenneth Branagh clearly thinks he is.
He literally said, I didn't think about it. Like, I didn't want to get singers and dancers for a song and dance Shakespeare. I only think that probably is him covering the fact that someone was like, you need to put Matthew Lillard, who was probably in Scream right around here, and Alicia Silverstone, like, in this. Because they almost seem like they are the outliers in this cast. They are the Americans. By the way, is Alicia Silverstone supposed to be French?
She is.
She's French.
She's a French princess. Yes.
But she doesn't have a French accent. None of the women have a French accent.
No, but that's I'm okay.
That's
with
okay.
That I'm 100% fine.
Yeah. Okay,
I will say, just because we are coming hard on it, I feel like whenever Kenneth Branagh and Natasha McElhone are talking together, it's incredible. Her. Like, they get it. Like, they're like, they're in a movie that I'm like, I would maybe have watched a straight version of this play, adaptation rather, of this play with them as the king and the princess, you know?
The straight adaptation is 4 hours. This has gone on.
So here's a genuine question about the actual play.
Yes.
And maybe someone could answer it for me. The mix-up that happens with the letter that was originally
Nathan Lane is in this movie. Yes.
Yeah, Nathan Lane is in this movie.
Who is, by the way, a lot. But I will say that when he sings There's No Business Like Show Business and he dances, I'm like, oh, this is what it could have been. Even though I don't necessarily love it, I'm appreciative of the way that he is moving and singing and dancing.
Well, not for nothing, Nathan Lane, I think, is the only actual song and dance man in this, production. You know, I think he's the only one who has any background. I mean, maybe I'm being naive, but like any of the supporting players, Tim Spall, seems to be struggling throughout. So Nathan Lane is the only person who seems to get like the levels that he should be at, you know? He's also comedic relief.
I mean, by the way, comedic relief in this movie, I mean, this whole movie is played as if you are sitting in the cheapest seat in the theater. I mean, right from the moment one, it is ring, ding, ding. Like, I feel like they are like plastered on Joker smiles. Like, nothing is for the camera here. This is for the people in the seats, like in a way that I have not seen a movie. It is broad.
To go back to the actual text.
Yes, I have a Wikipedia up so I can help you with this.
Okay, great. So can you take me through what happens and how it complicates, what happens with those letters and how does it complicate the story? Because the King of Spain sends a letter to the woman who Nathan Lane, I think, was caught sleeping with.
Mm-hmm.
Because he imprisons Nathan Lane's character, Castard, right? And then...
Yes.
And then the King of Spain sends a letter to Jaconetta.
And don't forget, he also sings, I get a kick out of you. let's not give short shrift to the fact that Tim Spall has his own song. It's I Get a Kick Out of You, and it's wild.
My story is much too sad to be told, but practically everything leaves me totally cold. The only exception I know is the case when I'm out on a quiet spree, fighting vain in the old home, and I suddenly turn and see your fabulous fights.
Yeah, when he pops his head up with all that cocaine Scarface style in that song, I was like, wow, yeah. Okay, all right, we're there.
But here's my question. Like, what? That letter, at the same time, Kenneth Branagh sent a letter, correct?
Yes, to Natasha McElhone.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he sends that letter to Rosaline, and the wrong letter gets delivered. So his letter goes to Jacquenetta, and the King of Spain's letter goes to Rosaline, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Now, how does that change the course of events?
Well,
because it's such a classic Shakespearean whoopsie-doo.
Yeah, mix up.
Yep. Yeah. But I didn't understand. Usually those mistakes have consequences.
Yeah. In this production, it didn't seem to, because like it never was. There was never an execution of that confusion, right? Like we never saw there to be almost immediately. We then kind of segue into the masquerade dance and Kenneth Branagh, you know, everybody seems to be still connected.
Yes, I think I understand how it may play out here. So I'm going to read this to you. This is from the plot synopsis on Wikipedia. It says simply this. In visiting the princess and her ladies at the camp, the king falls in love with the princess, as do the lords with the ladies. Baron gives Costard a letter to deliver to the Lady Rosaline, which Costard switches with Don Armando's letter, which is meant for Jacquenetta. Jacquenetta consults two scholars, who conclude the letter is written by Baron and instruct her to tell the king. Jacquenetta and Costard enter with Baron's letter and accuse him of treason. Baron confesses to breaking the oath, explaining that the only study worthy of mankind is that of love, and he and the other men collectively decide to relinquish the vow.
But
so,
that scene never happened.
Yeah. That's not in here.
Yeah. So that
because
probably was a
I assume
a bad
to
cut.
Make room for musical numbers. That I believe
was
that,
that not,
scene
yeah, did
is
that
not
come
in
out
here.
In a musical number? Did that not get covered by
the library?
The library scene. I mean, by the way, I did laugh when the king was like held up a plant and said he was hiding behind a bush.
I enjoyed that scene.
They do stuff like that throughout where they try and be clever about using like the words to like that. I was hiding in this bush and he's just holding a plant, you know, like. Because he wants to stage it in the library instead of outside or whatever.
But also this movie, like, I guess what also bothered me about this film was that it was so on a soundstage too, so it looked so unimpressive. Like if you're gonna shoot it, it just felt like there was a scene where they're outdoors in like a courtyard, and I was like, oh, this I feel like I'm looking at a soundstage. Like there's no sky, like, yet there are cutouts for
you
just
know,
darkness.
Here's what I'm going to say. I felt the same. You know, I absolutely felt the same. But I was like, if this had been done well, this wouldn't bother me. Right?
I think it should have been done in black and white.
Of it wouldn't bother this. How clumsy they did it makes the staging seem even worse.
But
you
if
know?
You're going to do like a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers kind of a musical like this, you know, old 1930s style thing, make it in black and white and invest in it. I think the color actually brought it down, kind of the opposite of what Cherry Moon did, which was
great.
It flipped it.
Like great here, point. I think they do, you know, he's clearly paying homage to all of these 30s kind of all these songs, but then also all those movie tropes and also the backdrop of World War II. And also he's doing all of this. Like there's also a lot of like physical Chaplin-esque comedy bits like that are just like overtly broad pratfalls and like clownish stuff that I'm like, I also don't understand how this fits into this movie.
Well,
like,
they do. I mean, they do tap dance in iambic pentameter, which I mean, it was I feel like there's so much padding on the back there.
Have at you then, affection's men at arms. Consider what you first did swear unto.
Too fast.
To study
and to see no woman.
Flat treason against the kingly state of youth.
But like this idea, like, I feel like that's what the whole movie feels like. Did you see what we did there? Do you see what we did? Like, they're so proud of what they're doing that they forgot to actually do the thing.
It really is. It is like Cats. I clicked on the time bar and realized I'd been watching it for almost an hour and had no idea what was going on. I was like, have they started the plot yet? Like, what's the... I really struggled with, like, who are these characters? Besides the obvious, I've taken a vow to not fall in love. Oh, no, I'm in love. Like, that's it? And in fact, that is it, you know?
But it's set against this backdrop that's fucking disturbing because...
And high stakes, like the war.
Which is not ever really addressed. Like, the war, like, there at one point, the camera goes past a newspaper and it's like, tensions rise. I'm like, wait, this is like a weird way to do it because when the end comes, it is dark. Like, that's a dark ending. What, by the way, was Matthew Lillard shot? Did Matthew Lillard have like a weird beard?
Okay. Different person who did look a lot like Matthew Lillard.
I thought he grew a goatee.
I thought so too. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. But then Matthew Lillard was in. Two scenes later, he was in that montage.
Which I was confused about. I was like, oh, okay. But that was a weird, dark ending. Like, this movie is so light and fluffy. And then you go into a full World War II newsreel that is all in black and white.
Yeah. It felt very Sound of Music in that way. Like, whoa, things have just changed.
Up until then.
But also, like, it doesn't end with a wedding, you know, which is so interesting. I mean, I guess fine, but it was the ending was so not satisfying.
Oh yeah, like,
if we're
we don't even get the reunion.
No, they spend more time just like seeing all of them see each other across a crowd scene.
Well, I guess the play doesn't have an ending either. There was a sequel that they've never found that Shakespeare wrote, but there is no real ending. So this is a Kenneth Branagh interpretation of what the ending should be.
Wait, what? There's an ending.
The princess makes plans to leave at once. She and her ladies, readying for mourning, declare that the men must wait a year and a day to prove their love lasts. Don Armando announces he will swear a similar oath to Jacquinetta and then presents the nobles with a song. The end.
Oh, interesting. It is unsatisfying on every level. It basically ends. Branagh tacks on a like Casablanca homage to the end of this movie to give us a little bit of that juice, you know, to try and like connect those dots. But that's it. Like for me, Kenneth Branagh takes one of Shakespeare's weakest plays and tries to infuse it with life via beloved songs and homages to classic Hollywood pre-war, post-war film archetypes. You know, some real unspooled shit. it's a head scratcher. It really is interesting. Shakespeare really is, it's very difficult to do. And when people can do it, it's electric to watch. And when people can't do it, it is painful. Not pleasant.
Yeah. It's like watching improv. Like when it's great. And when it's terrible, it's just insufferable.
It's worse than everything else.
Let's talk about the comedy here. I don't know whether I want to start talking about the sheep that just keels over, which is so bizarre. And I looked to understand what that even meant. I didn't get it. And then I really want to see what you both think about Timothy Spall. Timothy Spall plays a character that is, I would say, in a movie of broad performances, the broadest. Take a listen.
A female, or for the most sweet understanding,
a woman.
Ooh. I, as my ever esteemed duty pricks me on, have brought to thee to receive the meed of punishment by thy good gracious officer, Anthony Dahl, a man of good repute, a carriage, a bearing, and a tabathean.
Yeah, no, this is this character. Again, like, I feel like this movie doesn't know, there is no cohesive tone or there's nothing going on here that makes sense. Like, Tim Spall is in a different movie. He's dressed absurd. He's dressed like a clown character. You know, if this is a Marx Brothers movie, like, he is like the guy they're all making fun of, you know? He's like got a crazy mustache, a crazy outfit. He dances crazily. He sings terribly. He's like a mess, which is somewhat fun to watch. For those of you who don't know, Tim Spall is in all the Mike Lee movies. He's Peter Pettigrew in the Harry Potter movies. Like, you know who he is. He's like a beloved.
And by the way,
I don't
slam the performance, because I feel like, again, him and Nathan Lane are doing something. What they're doing is out of this world. It is. Yeah. It is bonkers. And I feel like Kenneth Branagh is like, bigger, bigger, bigger. I mean, there is moments where Nathan Lane is pulling like a magician's multicolored scarf out of his pocket, or, you know, is like his hands are wrapped in like a loose rope as, you know, yeah, there's a lot as handcuffs.
And again, like, it, that all can work, you know. I mean, it is hard sometimes. I'm not sure. I guess there have been adaptations to film that worked. I mean, I love Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. I loved it.
Also, I will say, a successful integration of pop music into a Shakespearean narrative. Like, I think
that
what Baz Luhrmann did unequivocally works.
Yes, and, but they also weren't singing. The actors weren't singing themselves.
Yes. Yes, but the music was such a
potent... music was hypnotic. It was perfect.
Such a potent part of that adaptation. And you know, there have been other adaptations that have...
West Side Story. I mean, essentially, right?
Well, that is not Shakespeare. That is like inspired... That's a version of, you know?
Right. I mean, but this is kind of that too, in a weird way, right? Because it's like, it's enough of it's not just they took the text and put it on something else. Because at certain points, they're not speaking in Shakespeare. They're not speaking the language.
I think they are. Are they? Okay. Except for the newsreels. I mean, except the newsreels, yes, and obviously the singing. But
there's
I
a couple
think
of
other than that,
asides.
It is the text. Oh, really?
There's a couple of asides. Nathan Lane has a couple of comedic asides that are not... Like when he pulled.
Oh, like, when he's the, like,
Yeah, when the moment just when Paul just said when he's pulling out the scarves, and then the scarves end in, I think, like a pair of underwear or something.
Yes.
He's like, what? You know, he's like, he has like an exclamation. He has like a couple of things that are not in there, but that's
so
it.
So 10
it's
Things I
much.
Hate About You is not traditional. Like, people don't put that in the canonical Shakespeare, you know.
I don't think so.
That was okay.
Huh. It's the same as the I don't think the moonlighting episode of Taming of the Shrew.
I think you might be wrong. We'll have to go to we'll have to go to the people on this one. But no, there. I mean, look, I think that, like,
by the way, moonlighting, you cannot find moonlighting streaming or to buy.
What?
At
funny you
all.
Say that. I've looked for it.
Same.
Yeah.
I just looked for it again.
Why are they?
There's a rights
it's music
issue.
Rights. It's
there's
music
a yeah. There's
rights.
A yeah. Yeah, there's a big rights issue, and I believe that, as with everything, it will eventually come, because every streaming service needs stuff.
I need moonlighting right now.
Oh, I would
like,
love to watch
almost that. I've watched almost every single episode of Magnum PI, the original, so, like, come on, guys.
Agnes DePesto, let's get her in here.
Oh my god, Agnes DePesto. There's nobody better than Agnes DePesto.
Oh, I love that show so much. It was so
remember,
fun.
There's an episode of Moonlighting that is a Murder on the Orient Express riff that is fantastic.
Oh, so much good stuff. And you know me, I was a big fan of Bruce Willis's singing. So, you know,
the return of Bruno.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really like a strong answer, but I think it's in that same realm of like why SCTV didn't stream for a long time. Maybe it's a music issue. Maybe it's like a rights issue. A lot of things get caught up.
That
like Human
was the
Giant
case
right
for
now. We 30 can't get.
Something as well. 30 something had a lot of music, like baby boomer music baked into the show. And then they suddenly were like, oh, we can't license this all.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, like, I know that there's not that much more. I mean, we're talking about a lot of stuff, but I
it
mean,
is clear to me that Kenneth Branagh thinks he is like a song and dance man, and that is how he got here, you know? And it's not uncommon. Listen, it's not uncommon for people to modernize or adapt Shakespeare to fit the times or to comment on what's going on. It's not even, you know, I think Ian McKellen do a Richard III that is that it takes place also in Nazi Germany, I think.
Oh, yeah, that was a great one. That was amazing. I remember that. I love that.
I'm almost positive.
Richard III. Yeah, it was Richard
III. I'm almost positive that's
with
what
Annette
it is,
Bening. But, yeah.
Yeah, and that's really good because they're not also trying to ham-fistedly shove in like Gershwin songs. I mean, like, what
I guess to me,
movie?
You know, you said it earlier to me, and I think this is probably, I didn't feel like any of these characters really liked each other. Like, it's supposed to be like they're so in love with each other. And I just didn't feel like that. Like, it didn't feel like a feel good romance. Like, I wasn't happy. I knew it was going to happen. Like, I don't know. I was more nervous about the men.
I almost feel like maybe, I don't know what you guys think. I almost feel like Kenneth Branagh thought, I'm going to cut out dialogue that shows us, or that tells us, rather, what you just said, that these people like each other. I'm going to cut out the dialogue that tells us these people are getting along or falling in love, and I'm going to let the songs show us that, you know?
Oh.
And update, the songs are not doing the work.
And was that sequence where they were wearing masks and they all switched partners, was that a dream sequence or that actually happened?
So this is the other thing. Like, I remember that as a plot point in the play, that the women, it's again like another Shakespearean device of the women are in disguises, and then I think, or they switch costumes with each other to pretend they're the other characters, the other maidens, and then the men come in and are in disguises, and it's again supposed to be a real mix-up. But
okay,
God,
so they,
if I couldn't tell what were the consequences of that sequence?
Also, I will say this. The way that that specific musical number, the Masquerade Masks number, is edited is insane. It is an enormous dance number with like the eight main characters plus other people. It is huge, but everything is rapid cut on hyper close-ups of them like touching their
humping
crotches, licking their necks, touching their, it's all like super close close-ups, and then chop, 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 chop in the edit. And it's like, this is not a good song and dance number. This is not a good, this isn't how you should film.
They needed
this
to edit around it. Like, there's literally a shot when Nathan Lane is singing, and it's a different sequence, but singing to like the camera's above him and he's looking up at the camera. Great shot. Really, again, I like this Nathan Lane song because he's the only one that's kind of can do it. And then they do a camera like at the regular level, and Nathan Lane is still looking up.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's bizarre. Why is he still looking up? Like, that's,
I mean, again, the other thing about that sequence and those strange like close-ups of like people grabbing each other's asses and humping and it's a bunch of like Matthew Lillard's and Alicia Silverstone's and then Kenneth Branagh in the mix, and it just was very uncomfortable, and I don't want to see him that way.
I don't want to see a Randy Branagh. Like, I don't like a Randy.
No,
like,
I'm not
like,
interested.
Wait, are you talking about his brother Randy Branagh? that's like Rooster McConaughey. That's my preferred. Randy Branagh is my preferred. He's like the guy you want to have a pint at the pub with.
But here's the thing about why I don't want to see Randy Branagh, and this has nothing to do with anything in real life, but there is an energy of him that like, is he really like that? And if he is, I would feel uncomfortable around it. Like, is he like a super horn dog? I'm not saying he is. I'm just saying, but that, I think when somebody gives off the present, like the energy that they are, that it's even worse. Like there's something about
it. You know, there's something about how uptight everything is. Like, the movie is predicated on like this idea of, we're going to sign an oath for, you know, foregoing interactions with women, right? Or don't they even say we won't even talk to women until our studies are complete,
have to camp outside the palace.
Right. Oh my God. We haven't even talked about the scene where the French delegate of the four women are in four separate canoes riding down the river, and their male escort is riding a bicycle alongside them on the shore.
I mean, why did was love it, that.
Why was it staged like that?
Well, there was something that I appreciated about it, because the premise, like you said, Jason, is that these men cannot get down to the worldly business of studying and scholarship and knowledge because of women.
Right.
Because women are muses that are going to take their, you know, their sirens that are going to prevent them from actually studying.
But
and
wait. But
that's why I love they were reading newspapers. I love that was probably my favorite shot in the whole movie. Just all of them reading newspapers, riding down that river.
You're not ignorant, all telling fame doth noise abroad Navarre hath made a vow. Till painful study shall outwear 3 years, no woman may approach his silent court. Therefore to us it seemeth a needful course, before we enter his forbidden gates, to know his pleasure. And in that behalf, bold of your worthiness, we single you as our best moving fair solicitor. Tell him the daughter of the King of France, on serious business, craving quick dispatch, importunes personal conference with his grace.
I will say this, though. I like what you're saying, and I like the way they set that up, and I also like that scene. But the way that it's set up is that these men are fighting in a war, and they decide in the middle of fighting in the war that they're going to study for 3 years. Like that, or at least that's how
I don't think that's exactly right. I don't think the war is on their shores yet. I don't think war.
I think they're just fighter pilots.
I think war lies ahead potentially. I think the reason that war, the reason what tips it towards the war is the death of Alicia Silverstone's father late into the movie.
But
right?
The tensions are rising throughout the time. Okay.
Yes. But these, I think, again, these are meant to be. And I think part of the casting doesn't help us is these are meant to be young people. These are meant to be
teenagers. Okay, because I thought the whole time, and maybe this is the Brana thing, I thought this is more of like a Rodney Dangerfield back to school. Like, you know what?
No.
We didn't study appropriately. Let's go back.
No, I think these are supposed to be.
I'm realizing that now.
That's incredible.
I thought they already went through school.
Your mind is justifying the dissonance that the movie is giving you, right?
Right.
The movie is showing you like a 40-year-old man going to college with a bunch of 30-year-old men. And you're like, wait a minute, I have to make sense of this. That's why I thought he was one of the teachers.
Yes, okay.
But in reality, they're all, I think, supposed to be like 20.
I think because of the king seems so, like, I was like, oh, he's a king, so he definitely went to school. There was a lot of, okay, I was confused. I'm back.
and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong about this. But
no, I think you're probably right.
My assumption is they're all supposed to be the young people who then then basically because of the war, the encroaching war, they all then have to like leave studies and love behind and are forced into war.
The trick is like they should have been college kids going to school like, hey, for the next 3 years, we're not going to see women. Instead, they tack on this fighter pilot thing so they could tack on the ending. So it's like they're fighter pilots. Then they stop being fighter pilots. So they can go back to being fighter pilots.
I don't know that Shakespeare was writing this at a time where it was like you can't learn past college. So I didn't necessarily get the sense that, you know, they had to be 18. I mean, I think they were definitely younger than Kenneth Branagh, but I do think the idea of like scholarship and being a student for life was much more available to, you know, multiple generations.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Listen, for me, I just know that the country of Navarre places so much importance on education. Which is why I tried to go there for a semester abroad.
That's a tough
program. That's what I tried to do with Radha, and did you not get in?
I did not get into Navarre. No, I didn't get into University of Navarre.
June, do you remember what you did?
Like, oh my God, I can't remember.
Do you remember what your regular monologue was?
To remember. I definitely did a monologue. Well, I mean, it was modern, but I did a monologue from Oleana, the David Mamet play.
Okay. Of course.
I did a monologue from, oh my God, what Shakespeare play was it? Oh, it was Titania from Midsummer Night's Dream. She's the queen of the fairies.
I have to say that, you know, I imagine you were great doing that. But I was going through some old files the other day. I wanted to show this to you, June, but I didn't get a chance yet. I found an audition that I put myself on. I think actually you put me on tape for The Soloist. And it is hands down one of the worst performances of all time. I mean, it like
post it, post it.
I mean, it is. I am shocked. And actually, I got retroactively mad at you because I was like, how would you ever let me leave the house with this? How did I ever send this into anyone?
Wait, The Soloist, is that the Jamie Foxx movie?
I use a voice. I'm like, I never understood.
I don't remember this.
Please, I don't know.
I'm like, I was like, what? How could I have done that voice? Like, oh, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. I was like, what? I almost threw the hard drive across the room when I watched.
Oh my God. If I had access to all my old auditions, I think I would quit the business.
Oh,
yeah.
If I could
log into a website that was like, here's every audition you ever went on. You know, like every casting director has put them all in one place.
Yeah.
I think I would leave the business. I would be like, shame on me.
It's so interesting because I feel the same. Like every audition I leave, I say a prayer that I will never see those people again and that I will never, that they'll like lose all memory of what happened in there. Even when it's good, like it's just so, I just don't want anyone to remember that process.
And to be clear, if you had recorded me auditioning for a singing role, I cannot do it. The same for like very specific accents. Like if I've been like asked to, like I got an audition for the upcoming Lord of the Rings TV show,
yeah.
Right? And they asked for a very specific British accent. I worked for two hours and the coach was like, you can't do it. And I was like, I know. And so I was like, I can't do the audition. Tell them I just can't do it.
Wow. I mean, look,
I couldn't lock the accent in, you know, it was too difficult.
It's so hard. And again, I live in fear of that unearthing of something
but here's the thing, like, you know, we've been on the other side of seeing people audition, good actors who didn't necessarily give a great audition. And I don't, unless it's such a spectacular failure, and this is what I have to comfort myself with at night, like, I don't really remember.
No.
Anybody's it goes away. Audition. Like, it really does. And then you see them with fresh eyes, you know?
Yes.
So,
yeah, very, you have to really
kind of. I
hope
people extend me that kindness.
I also think
part of what makes a good casting director is understanding that a single audition does not represent your actual
talent. Does not an actor make.
No.
Agreed.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, we are not right for every role we audition for.
No,
you know?
and nor should we get every role that we audition for. And doesn't mean anything about your success. I mean, obviously, Sam Jackson brings something to a role, but he's not going to be able to do that in every facet. I mean, he's still a great actor. Yeah.
Wow.
You're really punching down today.
Savage takedown on Sam Jackson.
I will say this.
Anybody else on your list, on your hit list? Paul,
I'm just saying that, like, you could be a great actor. You could be
caught
a great actor.
You're gonna fire.
I will say this: that so obviously, only Nathan Lane was known for being in musicals, and they spent 3 weeks in an intense dancing and singing coaching class. They called it boot camp, which, of course,
oh wow,
yeah, and yeah, they tried to do it all, and the cast did their own singing, and it is. There is a nervousness to some of the singing I felt.
Paul, that a lot of the voices we hear on some of those songs are not the actors' voices.
I agree.
Yeah.
I wrote that in my notes.
Really?
These are not their voices.
Paul, there are things about you, like you never recognize fake boobs. And I feel like
I always recognize fake boobs. I'm like professional at
and
that.
And you never recognize like audio dubs like that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm known for the worst audio dub of all time. I believe it was in School for Scoundrels. I had to ADR a line. It's almost shocking how bad it is. Like, it is on the level of, I remember watching it on screen and like, why did that happen? Like, they couldn't get it any better than that. It was so mismatched. But yeah, I mean, look, I take it at face value. I look at the people opening their mouth and I go, yep, that's coming out of their mouth. There you go. Good for it.
I see mouths moving. I'm
all
stuff
on board.
I get it. Must be that. I like how trusting you are.
I am. I'm a trusting person.
With
June
movies and so forth. Like, you know, June and I come to things with a degree of skepticism that is, you know, probably keeps us from enjoying things as much as you do, Paul.
Absolutely.
Well, you see, this is what we're talking about. And obviously we have an opinion about this movie, but we are open to the idea that there are people out there with a different opinion. It is now time for second opinions.
The movie was a piece of shit, yet this person recommends it. Tell me, what is the message? Maybe that art is subjective. I need a second opinion.
Thank you, John Lajoie. These are five-star opinions culled from Amazon.com. There are 176 total reviews, 68% are five star, 7% are one star. And it seems like, according to Nate, who did this research, Shakespeare fans genuinely love this adaptation. This is a big hit with Shakespeare. Yes. John A. Townsend in 2013 writes, "We watched this on a DVD 3 years ago. It became the three-year-old's favorite DVD. She carried it with her wherever she went. It moved into greater favor than Cats. She is now 6 years old, and we've watched it again just recently. Fun. Five stars." And it says, and the title is, "Great fun in the case with our grandkid." So that's that.
Oh,
the 3-year-old is carrying this around like as a binky or a blanket or something like that.
I mean, like, this was like Hamilton to that kid?
I guess.
The way kids loved Hamilton?
I mean, and everyone's leaving their full name here. William Simkiss writes, "One of the best movies of Shakespeare I've ever seen. Some moments of comedy and how they are staged left us howling with laughter, literally belly laughing, enough to make our children come in running and asking if we were all right." And the ending, oh my, the end of the play by Shakespeare is unusual and brief. There's a sequel mentioned in history, but we don't have it. So Branagh, by setting it in the 30s, gives us an ending which is beautiful, heartbreaking, lovely, and splendid. It brings me to tears every time without a word of extra text. Just gorgeous music by Patrick Doyle. It continues the storyline in a very unique way, and it is moving beyond compare. 5 out of 5 stars. Title, ridiculously enjoyable. And then, let's see here. This one is, from Jay Walsh. Says, title is "More Branagh Magic." "One premise is that there are various ways of producing, directing, and enjoying Shakespeare, a premise I resisted with vehemence for years. I was one who wanted my bard as written and in the original times garb. Through the years, I have relented. I have come to realize that even in Shakespeare's day, plays were edited for the audience at hand, and even he prepared the script according to where and to whom it was to be shown. Liberties have been taken with this production, but they have been taken with tastefulness and knowledge of the preeminent Shakespearean actor-interpreter of our day. The production never fails to put a smile on my face. Once again, genius has smiled on Branagh. Do yourself a favor, a big favor, and acquire one of these available copies. It is out of print and not likely to be reproduced, so it's quickly becoming a rare collector's item. 5 stars." Passionate. Passionate. By the way, you know, talking about the newsreel
out of
footage.
Print.
Thank God that we're not in that problem right now. The newsreel footage was so interesting because it seemed to collapse time within 15 or 20 minutes. It was like, and then they ate dinner and everyone enjoyed the steak. Back into the scene. It was like, oh, okay, well, like they didn't really, like it didn't feel like it was proper newsreel footage. And because it seemed like they did three newsreels over the course of one meal.
Well, and the newsreels were not for public consumption. They were just for the audience watching this play. Like, the newsreel is related to the elements of these characters' lives, barely is it related to the events of the greater world, you know?
Yeah, that is
so
bizarre.
So it would be like if you had your own personal newsreel.
Right, and if I knew that
If it broke in right now and was like, wrapping up the podcast, as we've heard second opinions, we're headed towards plugs, but this one's almost one for the history books.
But it would be in the Kenneth Branagh fashion, me going... Wrapping up the podcast, we are heading to the ads. It's so odd to also have one of your lead actors be doing a voice that is the narrator, but not that character narrating.
This is peak Branagh feeling himself. really like, I can do everything.
Yep.
Genius has smiled on him. Genius has smiled. Well, the budget of this movie was... $13 million.
Wow. A movie shot entirely on stages, poorly,
yes.
That is staggering.
The opening weekend, $24,000. $24,000. This is a Miramax movie, so it probably was released in a limited thing. The worldwide gross, though, was just under $300,000. Oh. So it came in 306th place out of all the movies made in 2000. The top three movies of 2000 were How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the Jim Carrey version, Mission Impossible, Gladiator, and this movie was beaten by films that we've done on this podcast, Reindeer Games, Battlefield Earth, and Godzilla. It beat nothing that we have done on this show. So this was not a big hit.
This is a staggering...
Yes.
Misstep.
Yeah. This is in the tagline was a new spin on the old song and dance. So yeah, that's.
I don't know if you guys did. I don't think I'd ever seen this before.
No.
So I had zero knowledge that it was a musical, or if I knew, I had forgotten. So
yeah.
I start the movie and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Got it. Okay. Some interesting casting choices here. Okay. Trying to figure out what Kenneth Branagh's role is, because he's obviously 40 years older than everybody else. But and then when they started singing, I just about shit my pants. I was like, whoa, what is this now? And I wrote, this is a musical? ?
Well, I actually thought at first, I was like, oh, they're going to be singing Shakespeare. Like,
yes.
Okay. Like, I've seen some improv troupes do it well, actually. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. But then when I realized, no... They're singing just public domain music. Like, this is crazy.
Yeah. No, it was. It really is. It really is trying to, I mean, I think he's really trying to pump up this lifeless production with songs, but with
he wasn't
songs.
Forced to do it. It wasn't like he's at a rep company. Like,
no,
like,
no, I agree.
You know, it's like, there's no reason.
There's a long-standing tradition of this, but this was not a good version.
I believe that he was like, I just did Hamlet. It was 4 hours, and now we're going to have fun, and everyone will follow me wherever I go. And that was a mistake. I mean, you know, but who knows? Much Ado, which is great, and I think we all really love that. That came out in 1993. So he was really, you know, he was
that's
knocking
the
them
Kevin
out.
Klein Much Ado, right?
Yes, that's with Michael Keaton and Denzel Washington and Keanu. And oh, I don't know.
Much Ado is great.
Oh no, not Kevin Klein.
Yeah, it's great. I remember. I love that.
I loved
it was
it.
So good.
What am
so,
I?
So good.
Of?
Kevin Klein. I don't know what you're thinking about.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Move on.
Yeah, well, y'all.
We did it.
We did it. What do we all want to talk about? What do we have on the docket?
Nothing to promote, except I think I actually will go back and watch Much Ado.
All right. Well, I think we can all agree that we should all watch Much Ado About Nothing. Been great talking to you both about this film. And I want to give a big thanks to everybody who makes this possible. That's right. Our producer, Avril Halley, found this film. So we always turn to her to find these very odd choices, and this was definitely one I was not expecting to watch. But then I also turned to our amazing team that has been working so diligently in quarantine, and that is our producer, Cody Fisher, does an amazing job. Devin Bryan, who's doing all the mixing and makes it sound so good and perfect. Nick Kiley with all of our research. Of course, we have the ghost of Craig T. Nelson. That's Zach McAleese, who's doing this great art that you see on our Instagram page. He is also joined by the wonderful Kyle Waldron, who has been creating stuff for us for such a long time. If you want to ask us questions, you want to talk more about this film, you can. You can give me a call at 619-PAULASK. That's 619-PAUL-ASK. You can also visit our special place on the web, which is not our website, but simply a place where you can buy t-shirts and hats and stickers and mugs and all that kind of bullshit. You can go to tpublic.com/stores/hdtgm and you can see what we have on sale. Oftentimes we'll have something maybe even for this episode up right now. So definitely check that out and go to hdtgm.com to find out the latest about this show and how you can sign up for the mailing list, because we have exciting stuff coming up like another live show. And people, don't forget to rate and review this show on iTunes. It's very important. We love it when you do it. So I hope to hear from you all next week on our mini episode. Again, you can call me at 619-PAULASK. You can ask me about your love, your life, your job, or about this movie. I will take questions about everything and anything. We will see you next week on How Did This Get Made? How Did This Get Made?